It was a story that was put about in court. Mrs. Fisher, his landlady in Tennyson Street, Lambeth, had, according to the official court reports in the Times, suggested as much. The story was raised many times over the following decades, when people remember that he was still locked up in an asylum, to account for his illness. And until 1915, when there's an elderly man, he gave an interview to a journalist in Washington, D.C., and told quite another story, it remained one of the leading probable causes for his insanity. He branded an Irishman during the American Civil War, they used to say. It drove him mad. A week or so later, Minor, suffering no apparent short-term effects from his experience, was moved from under the red flag of the Advanced Field Hospital. The Red Cross symbol was not to be adopted by the United States until the ratification of the Geneva Convention in the late 1860s, and sent to where he had been originally bound, the city of Alexandria. He arrived there on May the 17th and went first to work at L'Ouverture Hospital, then reserved largely for black and so-called contraband patients, escaped southern slaves. There are records showing that he moved around the federal hospital system. He worked at Alexandria General Hospital and at the Slough Hospital. There's also a letter from his old military hospital in New Haven, asking that he come back since his work had been so good. Demand like this was unusual, since Minor was labouring still at the lowliest rank of the war's medical personnel, as an acting assistant surgeon. In the course of the conflict, 5,500 men were federally contracted at this rank, and they included some devastating incompetence. Specialists in botany and homeopathy, drunks who had failed in private practice, fraudsters who preyed on their patients, men who had never been to medical school at all. Most would vanish from the army once the fighting was over. Few would even dare hope for promotion or a regular commission. But William Minor did. He seems to have flung himself into his work. Some of his old autopsy reports survive. They display neat handwriting, a confident use of the language, decisive declarations as to the cause of death. Most of the reports are forlorn. A sergeant from the 1st Michigan Cavalry dying of lung cancer, a common soldier dying of typhoid, another with pneumonia, all too common ailments during the Civil War period, and all treated with the ignorance of the day, with little more than the dual weapons of opium and calomel, painkiller and purgative. One report is more interesting. It was written in September 1866, 2 years after the Wilderness Battle, and it concerns a recruit, a stout, muscular man named Martin Custer, who was struck by lightning while he was on sentry duty, imprudently standing under a poplar tree during a thunderstorm. He was in bad shape, the left side of his cap open, facing of the metal button torn off, hair of his left temples singed and burned, stocking and right boot torn open, a faint yellow and amber-coloured line extended down his body, burns down to his pubis and scrotum. This report did not come from Virginia, however, nor was it written by an acting assistant surgeon. It came instead from Governor's Island, New York, and it was signed by Minor in his new capacity as an assistant surgeon in the U.S. Army. By the autumn of 1866, he was no longer a contract man, but instead enjoyed the full rank of a commissioned captain. He had done what most of his colleagues had failed to do. By dint of hard work and scholarship, and by using his Connecticut connections to the full, he had made the transition into the upper ranks of regular army officers. His supporters in Connecticut and elsewhere were unaware of any incipient madness. Professor James Dana, a Yale geologist and mineralogist whose classic textbooks are still in use today worldwide, said that Minor was one of the half-dozen best in the country, and that his appointment as an army surgeon would be for the good of the army and the honour of the country. Another professor wrote of him as a skilful physician, an excellent operator, an efficient scholar, although, adding what might later be interpreted as a toxin note, remarked that his moral character was unexceptional. Just before his formal examination, Minor had signed a form declaring that he did not labour under any mental or physical infirmity of any kind which can in any way interfere with the most efficient duties in any climate. His examiners agreed. In February 1866, they granted him his commission, and by midsummer he was on Governor's Island, dealing with one of the major emergencies of the post-war period, the fourth and last of the East's great cholera epidemics. It was said that the illness was brought by Irish immigrants who were then pouring in through Castle Clinton. Some 1,200 people died during the summertime scourge, and the hospitals and clinics on Governor's Island were filled with the sick and the isolated. Minor worked tirelessly throughout the months of the plague, and his work was recognised. By the end of the year, though still nominally a lieutenant, he was breveted with the rank of captain as reward for his services. But at the same time, there came disturbing signs in Minor's behaviour of what, with hindsight, appears to have been an incipient paranoia. He began to carry a gun when he was out of uniform. Quite illegally, he took along his Colt 38 service revolver with a six-shot spinning magazine that, according to custom, had one of the chambers blocked off with a permanent blank. He carried the weapon, he explained, because one of his fellow officers had been killed by muggers when returning from a bar in Lower Manhattan. He too might be followed by ruffians, he said, who might try to attack him. He started to become a habitué of the wilder bars and brothels of the Lower East Side and Brooklyn. He embarked on a career of startling promiscuity, sleeping night after night with whores and returning to the Fort Jays Hospital on Governor's Island by rowboat in the early hours of the morning. His colleagues became alarmed. This was totally out of character, it seemed, for so gentle and studious an officer, and particularly so when it became clear that he frequently needed treatment, or such as was available, for a variety of venereal infections. In 1867, the year his father Eastman died in New Haven, he surprised his colleagues by suddenly announcing his engagement to a young woman who lived in Manhattan. Neither she nor her job has been identified, but the suspicion is that she was a dancer or an entertainer met on one of his Tenderloin expeditions. The girl's mother, however, was not so impressed with Minor as his Connecticut friends had been. She detected something unsavoury about the young captain and insisted that her daughter break the engagement, which she eventually did. In later years, Minor refused adamantly to discuss either the affair or his feelings about its forced conclusion. His doctors said, however, that he appeared embittered about the episode. The army, meanwhile, was dismayed by what seemed the sudden change in its protégé. Within weeks of learning of his extraordinary behaviour, the Surgeon General's department decided to remove him from the temptations of New York and send him out of harm's way into the countryside. He was effectively demoted, in fact, by being ordered to the relative isolation of obscure Fort Barrancas in Florida. The fort, which guards Pensacola Bay on the Gulf of Mexico, was already becoming obsolete. An elderly masonry structure built to protect the bay and its port from foreign raiders, it now housed only a small detachment of troops, to whom Minor became regimental doctor. For a man so well born, so educated, so full of promise, this was a truly humiliating situation. He became furiously angry with the army. He clearly missed his debauches. His messmates noticed that he became moody and occasionally very aggressive. In his quieter moments he took up his paintbrushes. Watercolours of the Florida sunset soothed him, he said. He was still a dab hand, his brother officers said. He was an artistic man, said one in particular. He seemed like someone with a soul. But he then began to harbour suspicions about his fellow soldiers. He said he thought they were muttering about him, glancing suspiciously at him all the time. One officer in particular, troubled Minor, began teasing him, goading him, persecuting him in ways that Minor would never discuss. He challenged the man to a duel and had to be reprimanded by the fort commander. The officer was one of Minor's best friends, said the commander, and both he and the friend later said they were incredulous that they had fallen out so badly, for no obvious reason. Nothing anyone could do to explain. Your best friend is not plotting against you, is not scheming, is not wanting to have you hurt. Nothing seemed to get through. Minor appeared to have taken leave of his senses. It was all very puzzling, to his friends and his family, deeply distressing. It reached a climax during the summer of 1868 when, after reportedly staying too long in the Florida sun, the captain began to complain of severe headaches and terrible vertigo. He was sent with escorting nurses to New York to report to his old unit and to see his old doctor. He was interviewed, examined, prodded, pried into. By September, it was perfectly plain to see that he was seriously unwell. For the first time, suspicion turns to certainty with a formal indication that his mind was starting to falter. A paper, signed by a surgeon Hammond on September the 3rd, 1868, states that Minor appeared to be suffering from monomania, a form of insanity that involves a fierce obsession with a single topic. What that topic was, Surgeon Hammond does not report, but he does say that in his view, Minor's condition was so serious that he was to be classified as delusional. Minor was just 34 years old, his mind and his life had begun to spiral out of control. The sick notes then begin to pile up week after week. "He is, in my opinion, unfit for duty and not able to travel," they each declared. By November, the doctors were recommending a more drastic step. Minor should, in the Army's opinion, be immediately institutionalized. He should, moreover, be put in the charge of the celebrated Dr. Charles Nichols, the superintendent of the Government Hospital for the Insane in Washington, D.C. "The monomania," said the examining doctor, in a letter written in suitably magnificent copperplate, "is decidedly suicidal and homicidal. Dr. Minor has expressed willingness to go into the asylum and has said he hoped he had been permitted to go without a guard, which I think he's now fully capable of doing." Capable, but ashamed. A letter begging permission on Minor's behalf for him to go to the asylum without people knowing survives. He shrinks from what he regards as the stigma of medical treatment in a lunatic asylum. "He doesn't know that I write this. He'd be grateful to anyone whose influence would place him under medical treatment in the asylum without its being generally known." The letter worked. The influence of the old family, the old school, proved effective. A day later, without a guard and in secret, Dr. Minor took the express train down through Philadelphia, Wilmington, and Baltimore to Union Station, Washington. He took a hansom cab to Southeast Washington and to the well-tended grounds of the hospital. He passed through the stone gates to begin what would become a lifelong acquaintance with the insides of lunatic asylums. The Washington Institution, eventually renamed St. Elizabeth's, would become infamous. Ezra Pound would be detained there, as would John Hinckley, the attempted assassin of President Reagan. For the balance of the 19th century, however, the institution would be known more anonymously as the only government-run site in the country in which soldiers and sailors who had gone certifiably mad could be detained, rehabilitated, locked away. William Minor was to remain there for the next 18 months. He was a trusted inmate, however. The superintendent allowed him free run of the grounds, then let him go unescorted into the nearby countryside. A century and a half ago, Washington was a very different place, fields where now there are slums. He walked into town. He passed by the White House. He visited the pay office each month and drew his salary in cash. But he remained beset by delusional fears. A team of Army doctors visited him the following September. "Our observations lead us to form a very unfavorable opinion as to Dr. Minor's condition," they told the Surgeon General. "A very long time may elapse before he can possibly be restored to health." Another doctor concurred. "The disturbance of the cerebral functions is ever more marked." The following April, his commanders reached an unoptimistic decision. Minor was never likely to be cured, they said, and he should be formally placed on the Army retired list. A hearing was held in the Army building at the corner of Houston and Green Streets in what is now New York's fashionable upscale Soho area to formalize the soldier's retirement and to make sure it was justified by circumstance. It was a protracted, sad affair. A brigadier, two colonels, a major, and a surgeon captain sat on the board, and they listened silently as doctor after doctor gave evidence about this once so promising young man's decline. "Perhaps the mental condition from which he was suffering had been caused by exposure to the sun in Florida," said one. "Perhaps it had merely been aggravated by it," said another. "Perhaps it was all due to the man's exposure to war, a consequence of the horrors that he had witnessed." No matter precisely how the madness was precipitated, the board eventually reached what was the only proper conclusion on how to deal with it, administratively. In the official view of the Army, Brevet Captain Assistant William C. Minor was now wholly incapacitated by causes arising in the line of duty. This was the crucial phrase of the ruling, and he should be retired with immediate effect. He was, in other words, one of the walking wounded. He had served his country, he had been ruined by doing so, and his country owed him a debt. If the beguiling eroticisms of Ceylon, his tragic family circumstances, his obsessive cravings for whores, his nostalgie de la boue, if any or all of these factors had ever played a part in his steady mental decline, then so be it. The line of duty had done for him. The U.S. Army would now look after him. He was a ward of Uncle Sam. He could be designated by the honorific phrase after his name, U.S. Army Retired. His pay and pension would remain, and in fact they did so, for the rest of his life. In February 1871, a friend in New York wrote to report that Minor had been released from the asylum and was on his way to Manhattan to stay with a medical friend on West 20th Street. A few weeks later, he was said to have gone home to New Haven to spend the summer with his brother Alfred, to see his old friends at Yale, and to busy himself in his late father's emporium, Miner and Company, dealers in china, glass and crockery, which Alfred and his older brother George ran at 261 Chapel Street. The summer and autumn days of 1871 were among the last free and tranquil American days that Dr. Miner was ever to enjoy. In October, with the red and gold leaves of the New England trees already beginning to fall, William Miner boarded a steamer in Boston with a single ticket to the Port of London. He planned to spend a year or so in Europe, he told his friends. He would rest, read, paint. Perhaps he'd visit a spa or two. He'd see Paris, Rome, and Venice. He'd refresh and reinvigorate what he well knew was a troubled mind. One of his friends at Yale had written a letter of introduction to Mr. Ruskin. He'd doubtless be able to charm the artistic demi-monde of the British capital. He was, after all, and how many times had he heard the phrase at the army hearings, a gentleman of Christian refinement, taste, and learning. He'd take London by storm. He would recover. He'd return to the United States a new man. He stepped off the boat on a foggy morning in early November. He offered his identification as an officer in the U.S. Army to the officials in the customs shed and took a landau to Radley's Hotel near Victoria Station. He had money with him. He had his books, his easel, his watercolors, his brushes. And he also had, secure in its japanned box, his gun. Gathering Earth's Daughters. Sesquipedalian, adjective and noun. Of words and expressions, after Horace's sesquipedalia verba, words a foot and a half long, of many syllables. A person or thing that is a foot and a half in height or length, hence sesquipedalianism, style characterized by the use of long words, lengthiness. It was also on a foggy day in November, nearly a quarter of a century earlier, that the central events on the other side of this curious conjunction got properly underway. But while Dr. Miner arrived in London on a wintry November morning and took himself to an unfashionable lodging house in Victoria, this very different set of events took place early on a wintry November evening and in an exceedingly select quarter of Mayfair. The date was November the 5th, Guy Fawkes Day, 1857. The time was shortly after six, and the place a narrow, terraced house at the northwest corner of one of London's most fashionable and aristocratic oases, St. James's Square. On all sides were the grand townhouses and private clubs of the extraordinary number of bishops and peers and members of Parliament who lived there. The finest shops in town were just a stone's throw away, as well as the prettiest churches, the most splendid offices, the oldest and most haughty of foreign embassies. The corner building on St. James's Square housed an institution that was central to the intellectual lives of the great men who lived nearby, a role it still plays today, though happily in a somewhat more democratic world. It provided accommodation for what its admirers regarded then, as they still do today, the finest private collection of publicly accessible books in the world, the London Library. The library had moved there 12 years before, from cramped quarters on Pall Mall. The new building was tall and capacious, and although today it's filled to bursting with many more than a million books, back in 1857 it had only a few thousand volumes and plenty of space to spare. So its committee decided early on to raise extra money by renting out rooms, though only, it was decreed, to societies whose adherents were likely to share the same lofty aims of scholarship as did the library itself, and whose members would be able to mingle happily with the aristocratic and often staggeringly snobbish gentlemen who made up the library's own membership rolls. Two groups were chosen. The Statistical Society was one, the Philological Society the other. It was at a fortnightly meeting of the latter, held in an upstairs room on that chilly Thursday evening, that words were spoken that were to set in train a most remarkable series of events. The speaker was the Dean of Westminster, a formidable cleric by the name of Richard Chenevicks Trench. Perhaps more than any other man alive, Dr. Trench personified the sweepingly noble ambitions of the Philological Society. He firmly believed, as did most of its 200 members, that some kind of divine ordination lay behind what seemed then the ceaseless dissemination of the English language around the planet. God, who in that part of London society was of course firmly held to be an Englishman, naturally approved the spread of the language as an essential imperial device. But he also encouraged its undisputed corollary, which was the worldwide growth of Christianity. The equation was really very simple, a formula for undoubted global good. The more English there was in the world, the more God-fearing its peoples would be. And for a Protestant cleric, there was a useful subtext. If English did manage eventually to outstrip the linguistic influences of the Roman Church, then its reach might even help bring the two churches back into some kind of ecumenical, if Anglican-dominated, harmony. So, even though the Philological Society's stated role was academic, its informal purpose, under the direction of divines like Dr. Trench, was much more robustly chauvinist. True, earnestly classical philological discussions of obscure topics like sound shifts in the Papuan and Negrito dialects or the role of the explosive fricative in High German did lend the society scholarly heft, which was all very well. But the principal purpose of the group was in fact improving the understanding of what all members regarded as the properly dominant language of the world, and that was their own. 60 members were assembled at 6 o'clock on that November evening. Darkness had fallen on London soon after 5:30. The gas lamps fizzed and sputtered, and on the corners of Piccadilly and Jermyn Street, small boys were still collecting last-minute pennies for fireworks, their ragged models of old Guy Fawkes, soon to be burned on bonfires, propped up before them. Already in the distance, the whistles and crashes and hisses of exploding rockets and Roman candles could be heard as early firework parties got underway. Like the fire-frightened housemaids who hurried back down to the servants' entrances of the great houses nearby, the old philologists, cloaked against the chill, scuttled through the gloom. They were men who had long since outgrown such energetic diversions. They were eager to get away from the sound of explosions and the excitement of celebration and repair to the calm of scholarly discourse. Moreover, the topic for their evening's entertainment looked promising and not in the least taxing. Dr. Trench was to discuss, in a two-part lecture that had been billed as of considerable importance, the subject of dictionaries. The title of his talk suggested a bold agenda. He'd tell his audience that those few dictionaries that then existed suffered from a number of serious shortcomings, grave deficiencies from which both the language and, by implication, the empire and its church might well eventually come to suffer. For those Victorians who accepted the sturdy precepts of the Philological Society, this was just the kind of talk they liked to hear. The English dictionary, in the sense that we commonly use the phrase today, as an alphabetically arranged list of English words together with an explanation of their meanings, is a relatively new invention. 400 years ago, for instance, there was no such convenience available on any English bookshelf. There was none available, for instance, when William Shakespeare was writing his plays. Whenever he came to use an unusual word, or to set a word in what seemed an unusual context, and his plays are extraordinarily rich with examples, he had almost no way of checking the propriety of what he was about to do. He was not able to reach into his bookshelves and select any one volume to help. He wouldn't be able to find any book that might tell him if the word he had chosen was properly spelled, whether he had selected it correctly, or had used it in the right way in the proper place. Shakespeare was not even able to perform a function that we consider today as perfectly normal and ordinary a function as reading itself. He couldn't, as the saying goes, look something up. Indeed, that very phrase, when it's used in the sense of searching for something in a dictionary or encyclopedia or other book of reference, the phrase simply didn't exist. It doesn't appear in the English language, in fact, until as late as 1692, when an Oxford historian named Anthony Wood first used it. Since there was no such phrase until the late 17th century, it follows that there was essentially no such concept either, certainly not at the time when Shakespeare was writing, but a time when writers were writing furiously and thinkers thinking as they rarely had before. Despite all the intellectual activity of the time, there was in print no guide to the tongue, no linguistic vade mecum, no single book that Shakespeare or Martin Frobisher, Francis Drake, Walter Raleigh, Francis Bacon, Edmund Spenser, Christopher Marlowe, Thomas Nash, John Donne, Ben Jonson, Isaac Walton, or any other of their learned contemporaries could consult. Consider, for instance, Shakespeare's writing of Twelfth Night, which he completed sometime at the very beginning of the 17th century. Consider the moment, probably in the summer of 1601, when he's reached the writing of the scene in the third act, in which Sebastian and Antonio, the shipwrecked sailor and his rescuer, have just arrived in port and are wondering where they might stay the night. Sebastian considers the question for a moment, and then, in the manner of someone who has read and well remembered his good hotel guide of the day, declares quite simply, "In the south suburbs that the Elephant is best to lodge." Now, what exactly did William Shakespeare know about elephants? Moreover, what did he know of elephants with a capital E as hotels? The name was one that was given to a number of lodging houses in various cities dotted around Europe. This particular elephant, given that this was Twelfth Night, happened to be in Illyria, but there were many others, two of them at least in London. But however many there were, just why was this the case? Why name an inn after such a beast? And what was such a beast anyway? All of these are questions that one would think a writer should at least have been able to answer. Yet they were not. If Shakespeare did not happen to know very much about elephants, which was likely, and if he were unaware of this curious habit of naming hotels after them, just where could he go to look the question up? And more, if he wasn't precisely sure that he was giving his Sebastian the proper reference for his lines, for was the inn really likely to be named after an elephant, or was it perhaps named after another animal, a camel or a rhino or a gnu, where could he look to make quite sure? Where, in fact, would a playwright of Shakespeare's time look any word up? One would think he'd want to look things up all the time. "Am I not consanguineous?" he writes in the same play. A few lines on, he talks of "thy doublet of changeable taffeta." He then declares, "Now is the woodcock near the gin." Shakespeare's vocabulary was evidently prodigious, but how could he be certain that in all the cases where he employed unfamiliar words, he was grammatically and factually right? What prevented him, to nudge him forward by a couple of centuries, from becoming an occasional Mr. Malaprop? These questions are worth posing simply to illustrate what we would now think of as the profound inconvenience of his not once being able to refer to a dictionary. At the time he was writing, there were atlases aplenty. There were prayer books, missals, histories, biographies, romances, and books of science and art. Shakespeare's thought to have drawn many of his classical allusions from a specialised thesaurus that had been compiled by a man named Thomas Cooper. Its many errors are replicated far too exactly in the plays for it to be a coincidence. And he's also thought to have drawn from Thomas Wilson's Art of Rhetoric. But that was all. There were no other literary, linguistic, and lexical conveniences available to him. In the 16th century in England, dictionaries, such as we would recognise today, simply did not exist. If the language that so inspired Shakespeare had limits, if its words had definable origins, spellings, pronunciations, meanings, then no single book existed that established them, defined them, and set them down. It's perhaps difficult to imagine so creative a mind working without a single work of lexicographical reference beside him, other than Mr. Cooper's crib, which Mrs. Cooper once threw into a fire, prompting the great man to begin all over again, and Mr. Wilson's little manual, but that was the condition under which his particular genius was compelled to flourish. The English language was spoken and written, but at the time of Shakespeare it wasn't defined, it wasn't fixed. It was like the air. It was taken for granted, the medium that enveloped and defined all Britons. But as to exactly what it was, what its components were, who knew? It's not to say there were no dictionaries at all. There had been a collection of Latin words published as a dictionarius as early as 1225, and a little more than a century later another, also Latin only, as a helpmeet for students of St. Jerome's difficult translation of the scriptures known as the Vulgate. In 1538, the first of a series of Latin-English dictionaries appeared in London, Thomas Eliot's alphabetically arranged list, which happened to be the first book to employ the English word dictionary in its title. 20 years later, a man named Withels put out A Short Dictionary for Young Beginners in both languages, but with the words arranged not alphabetically, but by subject, such as the names of birds, birds of the water, birds about the house, as cocks, hens, etc., of bees, flies, and others. But what was still lacking was a proper English dictionary, a full statement of the extent of the English tongue. With one single exception, of which Shakespeare probably didn't know when he died in 1616, this need remained stubbornly unfulfilled. Others were to remark on the apparent lack as well. In the very same year as Shakespeare's death, his friend John Webster wrote his The Duchess of Malfi, incorporating a scene in which the Duchess's brother Ferdinand imagines that he is turning into a wolf, a pestilent disease they call lycanthropia. "What is that?" cries one of the cast. "I need a dictionary to it." But in fact someone, a Rutland schoolmaster named Robert Cawdrey, who later moved to teach in Coventry, had evidently been listening to this drumbeat of demand. He read and took copious notes from all the reference books of the day, and eventually produced his first half-hearted attempt at what was wanted by publishing such a list in 1604, the year that Shakespeare probably wrote Measure for Measure. It was a small octavo book of 120 pages, which Cawdrey titled A Table Alphabetical of Hard, Unusual English Words. It had about 2,500 word entries. He had compiled it, he said, for the benefit and help of ladies, gentlewomen, or any other unskilful persons, whereby they may more easily and better understand many hard English words which they shall hear or read in the scriptures, sermons, or elsewhere, and also be made able to use the same aptly themselves. The book had many shortcomings, but it was without doubt the very first true monolingual English dictionary, and its publication remains a pivotal moment in the history of English lexicography. For the next century and a half, there was a great flurry of commercial activity in the field, and dictionary after dictionary thundered off the presses, each one larger than the next, each boasting of superior value in the educating of the uneducated, among whom, it should be said, were counted the women of the day, most of whom enjoyed little schooling compared to the men. Throughout the 17th century, these books tended to concentrate, as Cawdrey's first offering had, on what were called hard words, words that were not in common everyday use, or else words that had been invented specifically to impress others, the so-called inkhorn terms with which 16th and 17th century books seem to have been well larded. Thomas Wilson, whose Art of Rhetoric had helped Shakespeare, published examples of the high-flown style, such as that from a clergyman in Lincolnshire writing to a government official begging a promotion. "There is," he wrote, "sacerdotal dignity in my native country contiguate to me where I now contemplate, which your worshipful benignity could some impenetrate for me, if it would like you to extend your sedules and collaud me in them to the right honourable Lord Chancellor, or rather the Archgrammatian of England." The fact that the volumes concentrated only on the small section of the national vocabulary that encompassed such nonsense might seem today to render them bizarrely incomplete, but back then their editorial selection was regarded as a virtue. Speaking and writing thus was the highest ambition of the English smart set. "We present for you," trumpeted the editor of one such volume to would-be members, "the choicest words." So fantastic linguistic creations like abequitate, bulbulcitate, and salivation appeared in these books, alongside archgrammatian and contiguate, with lengthy definitions. There were words like necessitude, comatrix, and parentate, all of which are now listed, if listed at all, as obsolete or rare or both. Pretentious and flowery inventions adorned the language, perhaps not all that surprising, considering the flowery fashion of the times with its perukes and powdered periwigs, its rubatos and doublets, its ruffs, ribbons, and scarlet velvet Rhinegraves. So words like adminiculation, cautionate, deruncinate and attemptate are placed in the vocabulary too, each duly catalogued in the tiny leather books of the day. Yet they were words meant only for the loftiest ears, and were unlikely to impress Cawdrey's intended audience of ladies, gentlewomen, and unskilful persons. The definitions offered by these books were generally unsatisfactory too. Some offered mere one word or barely illuminating synonyms. Magnitude means greatness, or ruminate, to chew over again, to study earnestly upon. Sometimes the definitions were simply amusing. Henry Cockerham's The English Dictionary of 1623 defines commotrix as a maid that makes ready and unready her mistress, while parentate is to celebrate one's parents' funerals. Or else the creators of these hard-word books put forward explanations that were complex beyond endurance, as in a book called Glossa Graphia by Thomas Blunt, which offers as its definition of the word shrew, a kind of field mouse which, if he goes over a beast's back, will make him lame in the chine, and if he bite, the beast swells to the heart and dies. From hence came our English phrase, I beshrew thee, when we wish ill, and we call a cursed woman a shrew.